Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are jumping in with a great episode tonight. We've got a special segment with our good friend, Dr. Joe Holly. He's just been on a trip recently, and we're going to be talking about some of the things he's been up to. Before we get to that, though, we've got to bring in our other two guests, or actually our co-host and regular friend and weather personality, Kyle, but first, Sam. Sam, you are first of all, as always.
Ah, thank you, Jamie. Well, there's not a whole lot to say about Colorado. All things considered, it's cold, but normal cold, as opposed to the north and the northeast. And oh my God, Kyle Nelson, I guess this is like the coldest it's ever been, or some kind of record setting. I saw one temperature, although I don't remember where it's from, was supposed to be minus 40. Are you kidding me? We're not in the Arctic Circle. What's happening, Kyle?
Well, hey, Sam, and good evening to everyone on the Disaster Podcast. Yes, winter firmly has the Northern Plains and the Midwest, and soon the Northeast, in its very frigid grasp. Just looking at some of the current observations out there, the lowest wind chill value, so that's air temperature plus the wind speed included, is negative 63 degrees Fahrenheit in Northwest Minnesota. And that's where you're seeing that those things, Sam, like you mentioned on the Weather Channel, where that does have the possibility to cause frostbite in as little as 5 minutes on exposed skin. So this is the real deal. And what's happening is that we have a piece of what's known as the polar vortex. It's a permanent feature over the North Pole. And occasionally when the jet stream gets really wavy, going more north and south than as opposed to east and west, it breaks off little chunks of that very, very cold air over the polar regions and brings that Arctic air down to the not-so-Arctic regions. And we feel the wrath of that, at least our friends in the north-central and northeastern U.S. are or will be. On top of that, that's also bringing lake-effect snowfall to the areas on the downwind side, typically the southern and eastern sides, in this case, of the Great Lakes there. I know my folks got 8 inches at their house, and they're expecting at least 4 more tonight. So there's that to look forward to. And as you said, major impacts. Those especially, not just those populations that have to be outside, like students, both for K-12 and college students, but also considering those that have to commute to campus if they don't live on campus in the dorms, you know, and the conditions that they'll be experiencing, as well as your staff as well. And it also major impacts on infrastructure. So all of the water mains, the electrical infrastructure and things like that. So all that can definitely be impacted. And so always falling back on having some good pre-planning in place. This was talked about for almost a week in advance. And so this was actually very well predicted and is evolving just about as exactly as my fellow meteorologist said that it would. So big impacts, though, looking ahead beyond that, because behind it, behind the cold front that's swept through now, it's high pressure in place. So for the remainder of the week, it's going to stay darn cold out there before warming up next week.
Well, I have to wonder about the animals that, you know, livestock that doesn't have a barn to go into, or even if they do, they don't generally heat them. So,
well, and the farmers who are going out and feeding their animals, because they're going to go out, they got to go out to the barn and do what they can to keep them warm. And
exactly.
That's their livelihood. So, you know, Joe, I know this has got a significant impact on, you know, the very old, the very young, just like all these things do. But this is so cold, it's going to affect the able-bodied as well.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. You know, Kyle described it beautifully. This is going to be a really significant weather event, and I expect lots of records will fall in the next 2 or 3 days.
And a lot of damage one way or the other that we don't usually see from winter weather. So, Kyle, can we expect it to warm up next week?
Yes, Sam. Things work, thankfully. We are going to get that cold air to be ushered out of here by the end of the week. And over the weekend, the transition will take place from below normal temperatures to more near normal to perhaps even above normal temperatures. And so the Midwest and those folks up there, there is relief in sight. But for the time being, it's going to be pretty darn brutal up there. And of course, we can't forget about our inherently vulnerable populations, as was hinted at, the very old, the very young, but also our transient populations, those that don't have space to go. And thankfully, those communities, many of them have opened up warming shelters, both for day and also night shelters as well, in order to help accommodate them and so that they do not become a casualty in the storm.
Which makes me think about the homeless. I hope there are shelters for them and that they will take advantage of them. They may not understand clearly that this is not weather you want to be out in very long. So, Joe, what was the weather like in London last week?
Well, it was cool and rainy and breezy. You know, the temperatures were, I think, about normal for this time of year there. It felt very wet and, you know, highs in the probably mid-50s for most of the time. So cool, but not terrible.
Yeah, you can live with that. And, of course, you have to deal with the rain when you're in the U.K. That's how that works. But tell us what you were doing there, Joe. I know you were doing some interesting stuff, as always.
Well, it actually was a very interesting experience. So this was a conference of the International Resuscitation Consortium, which is an international organization focused on cardiac arrest research and resuscitation, and overlaps a lot with ILCOR and American Heart and others that are obviously in that arena as well, as well as a conference called HEART, H-E-A-R-T, which stood for Hospital... Oh, goodness, I've just blanked on it. Hospital emergency, something, and resuscitation training. I just blanked on that. But anyway, so it was that piece of it was sort of the resuscitation officers, as they call them there, for many hospitals as well as a lot of EMS personnel. So a couple of days of lectures and discussions and presentations about sort of the latest in cardiac arrest research and direction and ideas, as well as the purpose for my being there was to do one of our cadaver labs there to help demonstrate the physiology of CPR and the various adjuncts and permutations that continue to evolve in cardiac arrest.
Wow. You're just on the cutting edge of research on that stuff, I tell you. What have you learned lately that you didn't know before? I assume every time you do that, you probably learn something new and think about what you're going to do with the information.
Well, I think you're right, Sam. It has become a very fluid experience now. And, you know, the things that we have been focusing on recently, and that sort of flows off a meeting that was held in Oakland, California, two or three months ago called Take Heart America. And the focus, let me give you a little background on that so the rest of this will make a bit of sense. The focus of the Take Heart America group, which has now evolved to become the International Resuscitation Consortium, is really to look at all of the different recommended procedures, approaches, techniques, et cetera, related to cardiac arrest, and to implement all of them sort of in like a bundle. A lot of the stuff that American Heart does is, you know, rating the quality of the research and making recommendations, et cetera. And the approach of this group is, well, that sounds great. What if we took all those recommendations and we actually implemented them all? What would happen? And that's kind of where we got our start. Since that time, we've been doing a fair amount of research, and we've had, you know, our clinical trials in the field have been actually quite interesting as we have learned sort of the impact of putting all those things into play. And of course, as soon as you get all those techniques and things in place and start seeing the results, that leads to additional questions and ideas, et cetera. So the point is to try to push forward some of this relatively cutting edge research into the clinical arena and see where that leads us from the standpoint of the impact on cardiac arrest. And then at the same time, take the sort of more lab-based stuff that we are doing both with our animal models and our cadaver model, and taking the information that we learn from that and then trying to apply that into you know, trial settings in the pre-hospital world, and looking to see what, you know, if these things really do translate to improved outcomes in patients. So it's kind of been a long journey, I suppose. The latest thing that we've really been working on is a peek at the impact of supraglottic airways in cardiac arrest. And our concern was really that a lot of EMS services utilize supraglottic airways. They use them as a rescue airway. They use them as an alternative airway in highly time-sensitive issues like cardiac arrest. And nobody had ever really looked at how much difference that might make. Interestingly enough, there were just a couple of studies that came out about the time we were finishing up that looked at some, you know, clinical impacts of the use of supraglottic airways, and sort of found in one study that it was just as good as just as good as an endotracheal tube. And then another, it was a little less apparent. But I think the thing that really concerned us was that when we look at a lot of the data that came out of the ROCK trial, which was a massive trial with tens of thousands of patients in cardiac arrest, one of the things that wasn't really taken into account very much there was the impact that a supraglottic airway might have on CPR adjuncts like the impedance threshold device and some others. And so this study looked at the how well a supraglottic airway compared to an endotracheal tube during CPR and its many variations. And by that, I mean manual CPR, I mean active compression, decompression CPR, heads up CPR, mechanical CPR, all these different iterations of CPR, and tried to figure out what were some airways better than others at being able to maintain a vacuum, maintain a seal in the airway. And at the same time, was there an impact on pressures and flows in the vasculature of the anterior neck, primarily the carotid and the jugulars, with a concern that in a very low flow state like CPR, where you're not generating tremendous amounts of blood flow, that an impact, an obstructive impact by an airway there could be potentially very significant in the amount of blood flow that ultimately flowed to the head, and therefore could be a factor in outcome research on cardiac arrest, unless we account for what kind of airway we're using and realize that not all of those airways are created the same, we may well be confounding our outcome data and going forward need to look at a trial that ensures that we're utilizing an airway that can do the things we need it to do, which is not result in obstruction of or reduction in blood flow in the anterior neck and maintain a seal, maintain a vacuum, and be able to do so under the rigorous environment of active CPR.
Well, I got a question for you, Joe, knowing what you know. Where do you see CPR in 5 to 10 years? What do you perceive the likely percentage of neurological people coming back neurologically? And that, of course, is the goal. And I realize that's a big question, but take a stab at it.
I think it is a really big question. And, you know, it's a tough one to guess at because there are so very many factors at work. And, you know, I think if I want to take a stab at that, I think there's no question to me that we have the potential to quadruple the number of neurologically intact survivors from cardiac arrest that we currently have, at least that, maybe more than that. But I think, you know, the issue is sort of making certain that the patient population that we're looking at is appropriate. You know, we folks that are at end of life with a DNR that inadvertently get resuscitated and don't survive, you know, does that count against your numbers or not? And, you know, there's all kinds of weird statistical things we'd have to figure out. But I think probably the most profound thing that I have learned and continue to learn, because every time something else comes up, it fits this category. And the issue basically is that in cardiac arrest, it's all about these incredibly small but profoundly impactful details. Details as small as which airway you use and how you release off the chest during the recoil phase of CPR and how you ventilate patients and what's the timing of airway interventions and other things. How fast, if you do heads up CPR, how quickly do you take the head up? Do you have to do something before you raise the head up? In what cases should you raise the head up? In what cases should you not raise the head up? They're just thousands of tiny details. And there's no one of them that is the secret. They are all the secret. And I think trying to impress on folks that are in that world that respond to cardiac arrest all the time, and for them to begin to appreciate how incredibly impactful, you know, a pause in CPR of greater than 25 seconds is on ultimate mortality, it's going to take a long time, I think, to get folks to really come to appreciate that. You have to have people that are very passionate about it and who really understand it and work at it very hard. But I think the evidence certainly is pointing in the direction that if we can deal with all those details, we can address them and do it as best as we know how, that the differences can be pretty profound. I certainly know that the ability to generate blood flow is completely dependent upon many of those factors we were just talking about. And without blood flow, you're obviously not going to perfuse any organs, and your chance of resuscitation is very low, and certainly your chance of a neurologically intact brain at the end of that is very low. So it's all about generating flow and how to do so and then what else might we need to do? Are there medications that we need to give that may have a neuroprotective effect? We've seen some evidence in the lab that the use of general anesthetic agents like Halothane and some of those seem to have a neuroprotective effect. So, I could see a medic in the, 5 years from now administering a dose of a general anesthetic in the peri-arrest phase to impart what may be some sort of neuroprotective effect of that drug if that data pans out.
So it's all about finding the right recipe. You take all these component parts, be them equipment and timing and CPR itself, and finding the right recipe in terms of what works best in the big picture. Would I be right?
I think that's a brilliant way to say it, Sam. You're right. It very much is about finding just exactly what that recipe is, and then sticking very closely with that recipe to make certain that in the end we get a delicious tasting cake and not just a pile of ingredients that are a mess.
And I'll actually jump in here and continue that, that metaphor, because, the problem with too many cooks can often be that it spoils the recipe. So not only does the recipe have to be followed, but everyone involved in the process needs to be on board with exactly what that recipe is because of all the variables you've been talking about.
Oh, I think you're exactly right, Jamie. It impresses me that there are so many variables that it would be rather overwhelming from someone who doesn't spend an awful lot of time knowing what's going on and understanding what's happening. To just remember all those. I mean, I think you're going to have to pull out your protocol/recipe book, and that's got a checklist of all the important things that you ought to do and how you ought to do them and all that sort of stuff. So,
and a lot of training, making sure the field understands the recipe. And God, I love being called brilliant. Thank you, Joe. So Kyle, any thoughts or questions from you?
Well, Joe, I was curious if it sounds like a lot of the studies have been focused on medical cardiac arrests. What about traumatic cardiac arrests? Any discussion on that?
Well, we haven't looked very specifically at traumatic cardiac arrest. I think there are some things that are similar there. They're both, in many cases, maybe a low flow state if you're severely hypovolemic from, hemorrhage and that sort of stuff. So the shock state piece of that might be very similar. Obviously, direct injury to the head or the brain is going to be a different animal altogether. So we are not in that arena just because that adds additional layers of complication on top of things. But I do think there's a lot to learn from that arena. We certainly have a good sense now that poor quality CPR in many ways transmits pressure waves from the thoracic cavity into the head, and that those, especially in, again, really poor quality CPR where flow is almost non-existent, in essence, all you're doing in those situations is you're transmitting those pressure waves to the head, much like a repetitive traumatic brain injury, concussive kind of force going, bouncing off the brain while it's terribly ischemic. So, that it would imply that those things are much worse during situations where you have very low flow states, similar from trauma and medical cardiac arrest.
Jamie.
Yeah, and since Kyle came on, I it reminded me that there's another segment of this process, which is the pre-arrival for out of hospital cardiac arrest, at least the pre-arrival segment of the process, which is falling strongly in the hands of the dispatchers. Where is there anything going on with research on the effects of telephone telephone taught CPR, telephone taught compressions, or things like that, because I know that there are a lot of systems out there that are doing a lot of work on getting their dispatchers to really focus on getting bystanders to do good, high quality compressions.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. There is indeed a lot of research being focused on that. Part of what we've noticed in our collective group is, I think two or three things there. It's finding ways to activate citizen responders through, apps like Pulse Point and things like that, people volunteer to be on the app. And if there's a cardiac arrest close to them, they're notified and they can go over there and do high quality CPR. In other countries, particularly in the Netherlands and that sort of stuff, those programs are far ahead of our own and have proven to be pretty impactful. And pretty efficient actually in their ability to get civilian bystanders or neighbors to respond to a cardiac arrest within a nearby geographic area and potentially even bring an AED and that sort of stuff. I think the other thing is there is pretty good data out there about the ability of 911 dispatchers to coach people through the performance of CPR, and that has proven quite beneficial as well. And then the other thing that we have noticed and been focusing on is that some of the more structured response systems or dispatch systems take quite a number of seconds, 30 to 60 seconds in asking questions and sort of figuring out that this patient might be in cardiac arrest. And there have been some pretty big impacts in the speed by which the dispatcher can get the bystanders to initiate CPR by sort of restructuring that initial part of that conversation. That is colloquially known as no, no, go. And it's basically, are they breathing? No. Are they responding? No. Then start CPR. And it literally takes 15 seconds to get those questions answered. And we start doing CPR on patients. So the impact there can be profound as well. So there's lots of different things in the pre-arrival world that clearly have the potential to have a big impact as well.
Okay, dispatch boy, I'm sure you want to comment on that.
No, and what Joe stated is it's very true. Many dispatch centers across the United States and even internationally use a system called Emergency Medical Dispatch, or EMD. If you ever heard your dispatchers or perhaps your first responders talk about that, it's a pre-made series of those case entry questions that you were talking about, Joe, that we can get in a very short period of time. And of course, if you ever call 911, the first thing that many centers ask, because if it's a medical call, you got to get this anyway, what's the address? And they're going to confirm it if it doesn't match what's on their screen. They're going to ask the phone number and ask you to confirm it if it doesn't match what's on their screen. And then we start going down, tell me exactly what happened. And from there, are they conscious? Are they breathing? And we can very quickly from there push one button and we get shunted to our CPR instructions, as well as that sends that codes that call immediately for our partners to dispatch with very little information other than someone is in cardiac arrest and that we're beginning CPR.
Kyle, that sounds a lot less cumbersome than it was when I learned it, which was some time ago. It sounds like they're getting you through the questions faster, which I think was Joe was alluding to. So
right.
That
and
makes
of
sense.
Course, but of course, Sam, we're also assuming in this case, in these situations, I'll backtrack a little bit. In those situations, people that are calling 911 can be either very immediately with the patient, they can also be bystanders. I mean, we had someone pass out
in a bar in Aspen, and I had 5 911s light up at once. And so it's determining who's with the patient, who's a bystander, who can we get engaged with that person and get them to be a third party to a second party being right with that person. And also, what is the person that's calling 911? What is their mental state? Are they in a state of shock? Are they so stressed and so emotional that they can't listen to us and receive our instructions or even answer the basic questions? Because yes, you know, we realize this person's having a medical emergency, but if we don't know where you are and what phone number you're calling from to start with, then we have a very, very, very difficult time getting any further because we need that baseline. So if nothing else, we can send responders to figure out just what the heck is going on.
Yeah, I guess too many is better than none at all because people will assume somebody else has made the call. I've seen that happen a number of times. So, Joe, you're taking all this on the road this year. I know the next couple of months are pretty busy for you. You're doing training all over the world, basically.
That's true. The next big CPR conference I'll be attending and actually doing our cadaveric model demonstration there will be in Bangkok, Thailand in early March. So I am extremely excited about that.
I would be, too. I've never been there. Can't even imagine what it's like. But do you find it hard dealing in other countries with folks you may not be able to talk to? I don't know how much English they speak there. It shows you what I know. But say you did go to a country where English isn't the primary language. How do you communicate to your people?
Well, I don't have a tremendous amount of experience doing that. I know when I was in Bologna, Italy, I had a translator. But honestly, English is an extremely common language, at least where I've been in the parts of the world I've been in so far, particularly in medicine and science. And so, it seems to be kind of the common language of science, I suppose. And of course, most of the folks that are at one of these conferences are quite passionate about cardiac arrest, just as I am. And so, you know, they're eager to engage with you. And if there is indeed a language barrier, they're often there with somebody who can help translate and explain, et cetera. So it makes me go a little slower to ensure that, people do understand what I'm saying. I think it's another big plus for our cadaveric model in that the things that we can show there don't really need me to explain them. The pressure and flow tracings and all that sort of stuff kind of speak for themselves. They can see it happen right before their eyes. So that helps a lot to get the information across that we're trying to get across without having to listen to me talk.
Well, if you could see it and feel it, I guess that tells the story. So, Jamie, as he's talking about all these potential changes in CPR, I think about how that translates to training all the providers, some of which are not crazy about change, even good change. What do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting because I think it's changed over the last few years. I remember when I first got involved with EMS, The annual CPR recert was kind of a joke to a lot of providers, especially when I would teach, firefighters and some people, police officers, things like that, because their experience with cardiac arrest up to that point was no one survives. So why did they have to put so much effort and work into it, backbreaking labor, when they haven't yet seen a person survive neurologically intact? And it's hard to argue with that, So going from there, where I started, to where things are today from an educator's standpoint is pretty significant difference. People are much more engaged. And I think it only takes one, even in a system. So, and I'm in a rural system. We don't have that many cardiac arrests because we don't have that many calls in general. But it only takes one survivor to get kind of energized the entire unit, whether they were on the call or not, to say, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And that's what you build upon. And that's what I've seen happen over recent years. And Joe, you maybe have seen this too in your system, that it's changed. That thought process towards cardiac arrest has changed, partly because of things you've done, people like Mickey Eisenberg, those doctors and system leaders out there that have stood up and said, no, we can do better. And I think it's made a significant difference.
Oh, I think there's no question about it, Jamie. You know, we sometimes get frustrated that we're beating our head against the wall, et cetera. But, you know, change is hard, and it takes continued effort to make things happen. It takes repetition, and it takes seeing results. And so I think we're seeing all of those things, and I'm convinced that the changes that we're looking at and talking about are going to be incredibly impactful. I think it helps that we have a pretty wide swath of experts, whether they be, you know, pre-hospital folks, hospital folks, researchers, et cetera, that are all sort of on board with this effort. And then we're lucky enough actually to have great spokespeople. So, for example, A.J. Heitman, who is the editor-in-chief of GEMS, is actually in the process now putting together a supplement to GEMS that will focus on this recipe that Sam mentioned earlier and talk to people about this is all the stuff you need to be doing and here's all the information behind each one of those recommendations to support why this is the right thing to do. And so, you know, at some point the weight of the science becomes overwhelming and folks will, begin to jump on board or be left behind.
And I love that you guys at Paragon are leading the charge with this kind of, you know, this kind of training that involves physical proof of the science. You know, that cadaveric experience is, there's nothing quite like it, where you can actually see the effect of your intervention on a human body, on human tissue. And it makes such a huge difference. And you see, as we've talked about here on the show so many times, talking to students that you've taught, talking to you and the instructors that you guys bring to bear, seeing those light bulbs go on, seeing that aha moment where somebody says, wow, this is going to change the way I practice. And that's really exciting. So if somebody wants to get that kind of aha moment in their providers, in their system in some way, where can they reach out to you and find out more about how they can do that?
Well, we always love to talk to people and so we can customize their experience to exactly what it is that they're looking for. So they can reach us through the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. They can find us on Facebook under the same name. They can reach us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Awesome. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and Instagram or connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
Great. And Sam?
Right there with Kyle. All the social media outlets with under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. Certainly on our Facebook group, which is about 650 strong now and growing. And on the disasterpodcast.com website, where we'll find the Pod Medic.
Yep, and you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media settings. And, of course, over on Facebook in our group where we post our episodes as well as on the website. And we have discussions there. So join the Facebook group by heading over to Facebook and searching for Disaster Podcast. We've added quite a few people just this week alone. And we'd love to add you in as well. So please join us over there. Sam, I love these segments with Joe when he comes back and really can dig into the science. It's not necessarily, the disaster with the big D, but it is a disaster for the people and family members of the individual involved in a cardiac arrest. And every life saved has impacts that are untold and unforeseen until we do it. So I think that's important to keep in mind.
You know, we have to appreciate guys like Joe that are passionate about this, as he mentioned earlier, and all the folks he works with. But it's a good example of something different. It's a good example of cutting-edge medicine being not our everyday medicine.